to the Nutra Medical Report. We have Harley Steiner here. And Harley, you have lots of interesting things to say. So let's rock and roll.
Did you receive the article I sent you today, Bill?
I did.
Yeah, I mean, what I covered in that is a fairly detailed report on the completely deranged response to Trump's invitation to Putin to come to the United States this fall.
Right.
The proper term for it is...
By the way, I like your analysis. It's quite thorough, but there's a lot of points to it, because since World War II, Trump was the first one to dismantle the post-World War, war cabinet of the globalists that actually want to maintain dialectics, the conflict, and potential war that could eventually wipe out the human race and the biosphere. And what you're saying here, what Trump is doing, is the exact opposite of the globalists, both on the left and the right, because there's Republican and Democratic globalists that are completely lost their marbles, haven't they?
Yeah, the proper term for it is Trump derangement syndrome. But it's interesting to note, Eisenhower was not really allied with them, and it was very difficult for them to do everything they wanted with him at first, until he had his heart attack in 1955 or 56. Remember, Eisenhower promised to end the Korean War, and he did. He knew that it was a phony deployment that was part of the Churchill post-World War II division of the world. But Eisenhower, after his heart attack, was too weak, and he had both Dulles brothers around him, so he was somewhat hampered. Then with Kennedy took both what Eisenhower told him and what MacArthur told him to heart, but did not move quickly enough against these networks, and they got him. And since that time, maybe you could say Reagan showed some potential to do it. But remember, he was shot within the first year of being president. So
he wasn't really president after the shooting. It was actually his CIA director who was George Bush Sr. became actually the proxy president, didn't he?
Well, Reagan still was involved in things. Reagan did, especially in 1983, work out the whole strategic defense initiative with LaRouche.
Right.
And he did do some things, but he got weaker again in his second term. And hovering over the whole thing was the satanic figure of George Herbert Walker Bush. So you had...
Or should we call him George Herbert Walker Scherf? You know that story, do you?
No.
Scherf was actually the accountant and the manager for Nikola Tesla. And in fact, it's thought in lots of circles that Scherf was actually the father of George Bush Sr. It turns out also that his wife was actually the daughter of that British agent that his famous quote is, "Do what thou wilt is the whole of the law." A part of MI5 back over a century ago, and a satanic overlord of the high-level Masonic order. So people need to understand, George Bush is a very evil man, a senior. And, of course, that's why he considers Bill Clinton his, quote, adopted son-in-law, because they're involved with the drug trade, who mean Arkansas, etc. These are very bad people, aren't they?
Well, and George Bush Sr.'s father was an ally of the Harriman family and their personal bank, which was involved in funding the rise to power of Adolf Hitler.
He even got fined $1.5 million, but he never went to prison over it, did he?
Well, he continued to fund Hitler until 1942. Remember, right. We went to war against Germany at the end of 1941. It wasn't until September 42 that Roosevelt had the Harriman Bush Bank seized under the Trading with the Enemy Act.
Right.
So, we're dealing with some traitors in this country. And then, of course, Bush Jr. and Obama continued the corrupt post-war order, only now is the post-Cold War order. You had an opportunity during the Clinton years for a genuine reset with Russia. And instead, what was unleashed by the Clinton administration was a bunch of gangsters from Harvard, from Boston banks, New York banks, and London banks to loot Russia to the bone.
Right.
And I don't think people know the real story of what happened under Boris Yeltsin. But the Russian population, life expectancy dropped from 72 to 66 years during that period of time in Yeltsin. The birth rate collapsed, the death rate accelerated, and Russia went into a demographic crisis, which was not reversed until 2 years ago.
Right.
So the policy that was imposed on Russia was a punitive policy on the people of Russia, but a policy that made a handful of bankers, including people like Larry Summers, very wealthy. Now, the reason I bring this up is that this is what the whole post-war order has been: a looting operation, a series of wars, proxy wars, false flags, fake terrorism like 9/11, all for the purpose of what? To keep the United States in a permanent war and to keep its people ignorant and dependent on a lying mass media to try and figure out what's going wrong with their life. And so we now have an opportunity with a president who doesn't agree with that, doesn't believe in that, to shift the terms. And he started, and from the beginning, Trump's main point has been that if he could become a collaborator or have a cooperative, beneficial relationship with President Putin, then he could start reversing this corrupt order.
That's well, the corrupt order has, you pointed out in the past, but I'm going to summarize. The corrupt order involves three primary things. Number one, it means non-representative government. The perfect example is Europe. Number two is speculative banking. Number three is that the totalitarian control of the economy by one entity, which is the Fed Reserve System out of Europe, and the alliance between America and the former nations of the British Commonwealth and the European Union to crush national sovereignty in America, Russia, and China, because the three nations that are now powerful opponents of globalism and non-representative government, turned out two of them are Russia and China, which are supposedly communist, but they're really not communist, Marxist communists like Marx thought out. And number third is America. And if the globalists can't crush America and these other nations, they can't have a global new world order, can they?
And the fact is that Trump understands that. That's why he wants to meet with Putin.
Right.
That's why they've been trying to stop that. Now, after Trump announced early last week that he would be meeting with Putin again in the fall, all hell broke loose. And this time it was from the Republicans. People like Bob Corker, the little punk Marco Rubio from Florida, Lindsey Graham, John McCain from his deathbed piped in again. And what they all said is that this is treason.
That wasn't McCain. That was his tumor talking, wasn't it?
Well, it could be. But
yeah,
they took the line from John Brennan and from Clapper. And Clapper, by the way, let something loose this week. He said that it was Obama who called for the investigation into Russia in the 2016 election.
Whoa.
So finally, the story is getting out that it was Obama who worked through his longtime sidekick, John Brennan, and also through Clapper, to get Comey and the FBI into the case.
Yeah, I think eventually this is going to get back to Valerie Jarrett and Obama. But they're still operating to do a soft coup against Trump. And it's not just, by the way, a coup against America. It's a coup against a populist representative government in multiple nations, including Italy, Austria, Hungary, etc., where they've even put legislation against George Soros, who's collaborating directly with our CIA and the deep intel agencies to globalize. See, we have the proscription since 9/11 is to add enough more powers, including the FISA court, to be able to literally harass American citizens and control the world, not through representative government and our politicians, but through the intel agencies and the billionaires and their so-called foundations manipulating and controlling world politic. It's amazing, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. We have this story out now.
Yeah. I'll have the whole story posted up today. It's an amazing analysis, Harley. You should. Kudos to you. Amazing. We'll be right back. just want to repeat what we just talked about. This is where it comes to the idea of Lyndon Loesch as a geopolitical philosopher, probably one of the greatest philosophers of our end of the 20th and early 21st century. And the reason is, being pragmatic, he's not caught in left or right dialectic, neither am I or you, Hartley. So we're trying to find pragmatic solutions, and we don't mind disproving or proving that our previous thought patterns are incorrect, so we can achieve a solution that's pragmatic and not caught in the left or right dialectic. Which is why people who get caught in this left-right dialectic, whether they're GOP, Republicans, or Democrats, or globalists, what they do is they want to defend their position rather than find a solution, right?
Well, LaRouche is very much influenced by the philosopher and poet who his wife loves, Friedrich Schiller. And Schiller talked about the problem with what he called the bread scholar, the person who has a view for the purpose of making a living. And what he says is that the real philosophical mind loves the truth more than any system. And that's not really pragmatism. I mean, I think LaRouche would object to being called a pragmatist. What he represents more than that is the Platonic idea of always seeking the higher truth. And that's really not pragmatic in the sense that it gives you a good living or it puts you in a position where you have immediate influence. The problem with the world today is we have too few philosophical thinkers. Right. And we really have to fight for an education system which allows people to be philosophical.
Right. Amazing, isn't
now,
it?
When it comes to this whole question of what LaRouche has put together in the post-Cold War order, what he started with was, and this is in my article, this evaluation of the importance of this group that was set up in the late 1990s called the Project for a New American Century.
Right.
This was the neoconservatives. It was William Kristol and Robert Kagan who were the founders. But it quickly brought in people like Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld, and this became the Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration security team. But one of the really interesting aspects of it is in 1998, they went to Bill Clinton, and they said to Clinton, we need to get rid of Saddam Hussein. Now, Clinton, you may remember, bombed a couple of sites in Iraq, but did not agree to the idea of a regime change war. Bush came in and immediately said, we're going to get rid of Saddam. And they concocted this story that Saddam tried to kill Bush Sr. And then the second story of weapons of mass destruction, which was produced by whom? MI6, Sir Richard Dearlove, Tony Blair. That's where the WMD story came. It was the basis of Colin Powell's lying report to the UN Security Council. So this Project for a New American Century, what was their goal? They argued that the United States must be a benevolent, hegemonic power. In other words, the U.S. must be the only country that determines the outcome of events using our military power and our financial power.
Right.
And this is what the unilateralism of the last two decades was all about. Now, Trump rejects that. Trump's idea, you know, people don't understand what Trump means when he says America first. He doesn't mean that everything we do is right and that everyone should do what we do.
What you're saying doesn't mean America only, is what you're saying.
Well, I'll be specific. He means that we have to be a sovereign nation that puts the interests of our citizens first, not
right.
The interests of private networks, financial networks, insurance companies, defense contractors. But what we put first is the interests of the American people. But secondly, every other country has the same right to do that, to be sovereign and put its people's interests first. Then what Trump says is, let's find the common ground between sovereign states and work together where we have common interests, and talk about when we have differences. This is what Lyndon LaRouche has always meant when he said we need an order of perfectly sovereign states seeking mutual benefit. And this is the one country that picked up on this was China under Xi Jinping, the so-called win-win policy. And now we see that just this week, Bill, there was a conference in South Africa, the last 2 days, of the BRICS countries.
Right.
And the BRICS countries are expanding now. They're bringing in Indonesia, Turkey, Argentina, Nigeria, big countries that are working with the BRICS Bank. And the BRICS Bank has a gold backing, and its whole purpose is to loan money for major infrastructure development. And it goes hand in hand with the other banks that the Chinese have set up to fund global infrastructure. Now, this meeting in South Africa, Xi Jinping gave a beautiful speech where he said, look, what's the goal of a society if it's going to advance? It's to improve our scientific and technological understanding of the world, to develop new technologies, and to make sure that enough people are educated so that their creative impulses can go into first learning to use the existing technologies, but actually developing a higher understanding so they can participate in creating the new technologies of the future. That's how you guarantee productivity gains, and that's how you guarantee progress. Now, that's why China was able to lift 700 million people out of poverty. And it represents a discussion process in the BRICS countries. It's now being discussed all over Europe. What do we do about China? Do we fight them? Do we work with them? You have narrow-minded people like Merkel who are giving the stamp of approval to the European Union to not work with China.
Well, let me give you my kind of a little summary. Number one, I had been researching. We're putting in what's called Sunrun Solar, which is, I can say, the best way to actually put solar in, because they can put the whole system in, cuts our power bill down 60%, and we're locked in 20 years, but the thing is we're going to get solar. We're basically going to pay a fraction of what we did in the past, but also they service it. So if they need to change a panel, or eventually we get batteries, which may back part of our system. I found the best batteries are made in Shenzhen, China, called silicon salt batteries. And until 5 years ago, when the first inventor developed, died, his son decided to go commercial. Well, if you want to buy solar batteries in America, they're silicon, which are much more resilient than the lithium-ion batteries or even the nickel-iron batteries that don't operate at high temperatures. You've got to buy them from China. And the same with engineers. The engineers took the model from the Bombardier system in Quebec, Canada, and the European high-speed rail, and they improved it, 90 kilometers per hour in China. So those thousands of engineers, if we want to get high-speed rail, we got to hire and bring the Chinese engineers over here so we can leapfrog forward to better high-speed rail that's safe. The same way as technology for, it's not just Silicon Valley, it's Silicon Valleys. There's a Silicon Valley in China now, in India, in other countries around the world. And we have to understand, unless you collaborate with other countries, we aren't going to solve things like the defense of Earth policy, inventing the technologies of the future, growing safer food, stabilizing the world climate from climate change. All these things require worldwide collaboration. They aren't something we can do alone or they can do alone. Isn't that true?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we don't have a choice, to be honest with you. We might pretend we do, but it's cataclysm. It's a cataclysmic idea to think we have a choice. So, Harley, I'm really pleased that these things are moving forward, and I'm expecting actually a red wave and a blue wave. I've done some calculations from my regular and classified and other sources, and I'm calculating six more Republican Trump supporting and movements by more independents. In fact, we pushed for Keisha Rogers to fight Al Green in Houston, and she's one of the independents for Trump. I guarantee you that you're starting to get some headway with Trump and his staff around him with the LaRouche Foundation ideas, including Glass-Steagall and others. And as these things move forward, these kind of same ideas are popping up in Italy and other countries in Europe as well, aren't they?
Well, some of the people in Italy are people who have been in touch with LaRouche for 20 or 30 years.
Right.
People who are including academic economists. There's one named Banyai, who is one of the better economists in Europe. And I met him not that long ago in Brussels. He's written a number of things talking about Glass-Steagall. And he's now a member of the Italian Parliament on the Banking Committee. And he's drafted a Glass-Steagall bill for the Italian government. And this is something that the European Union is completely bonkers about. Because, you know, you look at what's happening with Brexit. What's the underlying issue with Brexit? It's the City of London. What happens if the City of London is not part of the EU? Well, the Brits are worried about that, the ones who are trying to reverse Brexit. But a number of the people inside the EU are worried about it because the money flows that go back to the banks in Germany, France, Spain, and elsewhere go through London. What happens if London's offshore banking is cut off to the European Union? What happens to the liquidity? Will the European Central Bank be able to create enough liquidity without being able to draw upon the thievery that's done by the City of London? So these are some very interesting issues, and they're being brought up in Italy because the Italian banks have already been looted by the British banks and also German banks. They're still being looted. And the European Central Bank has a policy of forcing Italian banks to do bail-ins when they are short on Tier 2 capital. In other words, Tier 2 capital in Italy means depositors' money.
Yeah, well, what that means is they're going to take the depositors' money, speculate with it, blow it up, and not solve the debt problem or even grow the actual physical economy, tool and die, production, etc. So as a result, it grows a speculative economy, which eventually is going to go pop. And when it goes pop, by the way, and I heard that mathematically, the whole world will be toward the pop level in about 10 to 11 years, 2030. But it could happen before then or shortly thereafter. At that point, basically, the world debt is unsustainable, isn't it?
It's already unsustainable. And right. If you had a bad derivatives contract in a major bank, the clearing houses that are supposed to have the liquidity to back up the derivatives don't have the liquidity. How do they get liquidity? If they just print money, then they will eventually reach a point of hyperinflation. That's what they've been doing. They've been printing money, and now they're trying to move toward higher interest rates to shut down the flow of free funds that go to the speculators. But right. If they do that, they risk blowing the whole thing up. So they're in a classic case of a damned if you do, damned if you don't. Now, this is why they're having such a hard time figuring out who should replace Mario Draghi as the new head of the European Central Bank. Because Draghi has been a longtime insider in London. He was one of the people who set up the system in Italy that led to the bankruptcy of the banking system there. And he's essentially an employee of the banks that are tied to the Queen of England. He laid out in 1995 a plan on the yacht Britannia, which is the Queen's yacht, where he was brought in to audition before the board of the Bank of England to see whether they would accept him as an Italian finance minister. Instead, they sent him back as a bank regulator in Italy, and he's the one who worked with Goldman Sachs to create the indebtedness of the Italian banking system as part of the price for going into the European Union. Now that it's all blown apart, they put him at the European Central Bank to bail it all out. And he can't do it. They can't bail out the unsustainable debt. So they're limping along, hoping that nothing blows up. They're still hoping that they might be able to trigger a collapse of China to cause funds to flow away from the Chinese model and away from funds like the BRICS Bank and the Shanghai Cooperation Bank to flow into the Western pools of capital. But that's not going to happen because the Chinese economy is not going to blow out. And by the way, Bill, there's one thing important on this. The Chinese Premier Li Qiang released a report in Johannesburg at the BRICS conference. And what he showed is that China has been going through for the last 2 years taking the air out of the bubble. And he went through how much of the debt situation in China was based on openness to Western banking in the first part of this decade. And after 2012 and 2013, when Xi Jinping decided to make the Belt and Road Initiative the Chinese economic policy, they started systematically pulling the plug on the banks that were speculative banks, arresting traders and speculators, and shutting down these bad banks, and then figuring out a way to reimburse the depositors, but not to give them the money that they thought they earned through the speculation. So they made sure that people didn't lose any money, but they took out the speculative gains as a way of essentially saying, this is not the way we do business. And the Chinese people are supporting that because they realize that otherwise they would have had a 2008-style banking crash in China. And just this last week, Price Waterhouse did a report saying that the Chinese are the only country since 1998, so that's 20 years, that hasn't had a recession or a depression or a bubble pop. So I think it's kind of interesting for people in the U.S. who think China's got a big bubble and a lot of bad debt. They're backing their debt, or I should say their credit, with real production. And it's a 20-year policy. They're not planning on recouping everything next year because they don't have to.
Yeah, that's interesting. Now, of course, one of the things that you mentioned before is that China is very concerned about not getting too entangled in what we call the bubble economy.
Yeah.
And this is a strategy, and I can tell you part of the thing that I'm very, very concerned about is how some of these currencies are actually moving toward, how can I say this? They're moving toward a cryptonizing their currencies. For example, there's even moves in America or even in Europe to cryptonize, and one of the nations that's against cryptocurrencies, in regular cryptocurrencies, not backed by gold, but just cryptonized currencies, is China. What do you think of that situation? Because the cryptocurrency thing could be is a black swan event that could, if it's deeply embedded into the economy or speculative banking and stocks, etc., could have a blowout, couldn't it?
The whole argument for cryptocurrencies is that you can't trust the funny money of the central banks. What if you get rid of the funny money and the central banks and go to national credit systems? Then you can have money that's regulated based on the improvements of the physical economy. And it would be ultimately backed by gold, but you'd never even need the gold backing because the money is going into physical production as opposed to speculation creating unsustainable debt. So, you know, the cryptocurrencies were an attempt at a solution to the wrong problem. The problem was credit policy or debt policy being in the hands of private bankers rather than governments that are concerned with the general welfare of the population. Now, on this currency question, it's interesting because the Chinese don't want to pull out of the dollar. They don't want to see a dollar collapse. But they're not going to allow the Western banks to dictate the terms of their credit policies. And that's one of the reasons that there's a problem.
Discussion. You know, if we're going to create what I consider the philosopher of Linda LaRouche and your organization, Helga Zepp LaRouche and yourself, I think we're looking at what I call a defensive Earth strategy. It's neither left nor right. It is philosophically trying to use the energy flux density and the creative power of our minds collectively to create a stable world that can recreate a world in the future where food supplies and economies are stable. We're defensive Earth against incoming asteroids or coronal mass ejections doesn't blow our power grid, where we don't have the danger of missile defense and missile warfare. For example, part of the reason why Lyndon spent so many years in jail was because he actually proposed to share missile defense with the Russians, which would have made sense. I call it defensive Earth strategy. And the powers that be in the globalists didn't want that. They didn't want us to share a strategic wars defense against missile warfare. I think it's essential that we do, so that not only major powers but minor proxy powers wouldn't have missiles that could destroy major nations. One missile over America could kill millions.
The other reason LaRouche ended up in prison was that he wouldn't sell out. He was visited by top-level people from both Britain and the United States and told that they would give him a professorship at a college in New England and a nice salary if he would abandon his organization. And he basically told them to get lost. He said that he's not in this for his personal satisfaction or for making money. He's looking at an existential crisis in the breakdown and the degeneration of Western civilization and culture. And he's devoted his life to develop the pedagogical methods to teach his ideas so that we are not left in a situation where we're in a dark age with no one who can think. And, you know, I think the success of LaRouche's method can be seen in the work that his wife has done to literally, I mean, without bragging, it's absolutely correct to say that there probably wouldn't be the same sort of Belt and Road Initiative, New Silk Road Initiative that China has today had it not been for the work of Mrs. LaRouche. In China, they call her the Silk Road Lady. And she's one of the few people from Europe who is invited to participate in all the major events that they've had in China to roll out the whole idea of the Belt and Road Initiative and the New Silk Road. Right. So, you know, we've actually had a hand in that. Just as we're in the middle of the fight, even though, you know, we lose most of these fights, but ultimately we're going to win the big battle. Because we're fighting with people who have power, they have money, they have media control, but their ideas are no damn good. They don't work. So if they succeed in wiping out good ideas, they're going to wipe out the human race. So if the human race wishes to survive, we've got to change the way we think. Get away from empiricism. Get away from, I only believe what I see.
Right.
If you look at the great scientists, they discovered things that they couldn't see that were outside sense perception, where they used imagination and hypothesis. That's the Platonic method. That was the scientific method that allowed.
You have to see beyond your senses in order to create new things. And it's my belief that the left brain analyzes linear data, the right brain nonlinear data, but questions and the ability to perceive beyond your senses comes from your higher self. The creative element of us that makes us, like it says in the Bible, now they are in one place and of one tongue, nothing shall be withheld from their imagination. Your imagination always goes beyond your senses, doesn't it?
Well, it has to, because if all we knew were what we saw with our senses or experienced with our senses, we'd be animals.
Right, we're not. And the other thing is we're also a collective organism. People don't understand this, that whether we're individuals and have individual representative government or nations, we can't get away from the fact that we are a collective organism, whether we look Chinese or African or Mongolian or white or Scottish or Irish or New Zealander. The fact is we're all really one collective organism on the planet, and we're supposed to be the stewards of planet Earth to protect it to not becoming an extinction-level event. And what we're doing basically is ignoring things that are creating things that will cause us to become an extinction-level driver for the world.
No, and there are a couple of things that man does that no animal can do. One is science. We can act in such a way as to use nature to improve the power of our own species.
Right.
And secondly, we can reflect on what we've done to produce history so that we can learn from what we've experienced. Now, experience is not always the best teacher, because sometimes you draw the wrong conclusions from experience. But that's where imagination, creative imagination, hypothesis comes in. You know, you look at Kepler. Did Kepler ever see the rings, the orbits of the planets? No, you can't see them. He didn't have the telescopes and the global positioning equipment and satellites and things that we have today that enable us to do that. he had a creative imagination, and he used that to come up with hypotheses, and then he proved from the hypotheses that he was right. So you take a unique individual like a Kepler or a Leibniz or an Einstein, and you see that it's people who didn't even necessarily have labs, but they had...
Well, he was a patent officer when he discovered most of the things that were in the laboratory of his mind. For example, one of the things that I've recently discovered, and I researched it, is I say that a question is an answer to is the direction that allow you to parse or cut the Gordian knot of a paradox or a problem. So one of the paradoxes is, what is aging? Well, I came upon this idea roughly 2 years ago, that the only time when you don't age is when you're in utero in your fetus. And so we were selling red deer velvet for about 12 years from New Zealand. We discovered a technology we patented now that preserves the molecules that returns you to the fetal state. So, again, there's an answer. The same thing as Nikola Tesla, when he discovered that alternative current can carry power a long distance rather than direct current can't. As each of these things are discovered, we create a new type of world or worldview that allows us to create a world that is beyond our senses, right?
And it's the ability to go outside of sense perception as a method,
right,
which is the driver for advance. That's why LaRouche is so insistent that besides Glass-Steagall separation, a credit policy, and infrastructure investment, his fourth law is that a portion, a significant portion of what's invested in new technologies has to go outside of what we know. For example, plasma technologies or nuclear fusion or space exploration, so that we can take up the challenges that exist outside of what we already know. And then what we discover is that what we thought we knew wasn't right. And so we then make adjustments to allow for our new discoveries. Now, that's what Schiller called being axiomatically revolutionary.
Right. For example, right now we use alternative current, and we do still need power stations to boost the power as we do across the country in the grid, which also is, by the way, fragile because of coronal mass ejections and danger of cyber hacking and even EMP from, say, weapons like a satellite like North Korea that crosses our airspace. But if we had, let's say, buried power lines of plasma distribution lines to where it's not alternating current but plasma, and if we hardened our power grid with surge protectors and the type of technology that protected, we wouldn't have the danger of collapse, because our fragile world is very electrical based. Unless we kind of imagineer beyond that, we're going to have a collapse just from the fact that the electrical system isn't sustainable. And we need to think of that now, not just for America, but the whole world, because the world economy is very interactive. If a coronal mass ejection hits, say, Europe or America, the whole world economy is going to crash because it's all interlocked now.
Well, what all of this tells you is that we can't afford the kind of idiocy that we see from senators like Corker and Menendez of New Jersey, a Democrat, from the Obama crew,
right,
people like Brennan and Clapper. They're trying to keep everything inside a box.
Right.
If they could succeed, they'll destroy Trump, they'll destroy the hopes of people to break out of this, and we're going to end up in World War III in short order. We won't have to worry about coronal mass ejections because we'll destroy ourselves out of our own stupidity in a nuclear war.
Right.
That's why we have to defeat these guys. And people should go to my website, LaRouchePack.com. We have plenty of material on this. And Bill, I appreciate you posting my article and people could...
That article will be up, and also the link to LaRouche Pack. The other website is the Executive Intelligence Review, EIR, at LaRouchePUB.com. Thank you, Harley. Always wise. I mean, I always enjoy when I listen to co-hosts that teach me, make me feel wiser at the end of the show, and make me feel more positive about the collective nature of humanity making a brighter future rather than heading toward an apocalypse.
Well, it's good talking with you, Bill.
Amazing show. We're going to be back in a moment with hour number three to end up the week with Gary Richard Arnold and lots of amazing things. We'll probably do some videos tomorrow afternoon, too, with his pictures and diagrams and charts.